Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. And for this episode, I'll be covering revisionism, denialism, and pseudo-history. And no real announcements for this program. I've got a couple more good positive feedbacks on iTunes, so I really do appreciate that. I do realize I'm still got some recording issues going on. I won't go into the gory details, but I'm still trying to work on it, try to get the volume up. And the only other announcement is just a reminder: I'm still looking for some listener participation on this look at the book 1984. You know, if you have any thoughts, I mean, it would be nice to, I mean, it's just a way to understand your feelings about the book. If you have any questions about recording, you know, just send me an email at feedback@mikebowler.com. I'm more than happy to help you out. And for this episode, I'd like to cover some aspects of history, revisionism, pseudo-history, and denialism, and why these are important to understand as part of conspiracy theories. The concept of revisionism is history's, at least in the context of history, is kind of the same as what we see in science, where the scientific method, you propose a hypothesis, you test that hypothesis, you study, you measure, and depending on what you're studying, the methods you use to identify and quantify what you're observing. And in that process, you have certain checks and balances during your study. You'll hear things like blinding, double blinding, sometimes triple blinding, depending on what you're studying. And the idea is to eliminate as much bias, false positives, that type of thing. And of course, once this is all done and you write up your report, the idea is to publish your findings. And of course, now the next process is what's usually referred to as a peer review, where your write-up is picked apart, analyzed, published, and then fellow scientists will comment. They may try to replicate your findings. And if it holds true, this new study, you know, and this new information gets applied to what was already understood and used to build, usually it's referred to as a model. In the scientific world, this is how hypotheses turn into theories and with any luck may become a law. But, this is a fairly rigorous, endeavor. Sometimes fraud does creep in. But in effect, hopefully, and it seems like in a few cases, the fraud has been pretty much, you know, does get caught. In history, there's a similar type of system, though it doesn't seem as rigorous. I mean, at least in my opinion, doesn't seem as rigorous as the scientific, dealing with the physical sciences. We're dealing now with more social, more human interaction type stuff. But in a way, there's still the same kind of methods that are being used. Historians generally they'll be researching. They will mostly, it's going through archives. They may be talking to people who were there, people who were involved, perhaps relying on previously written documentation on major players, and again, performing this research, drawing a conclusion, and publishing this in a journal, or maybe produce a book, or what have you. And then their peers will comment on this book and say, find the faults, so on and so forth. Kind of the same, but I want to say the bit in the major differences is that in the physical sciences, you have a actual, you can quantify and you can basically attach a number to what you're observing. In history, that is not as clear cut. You can't apply a number to what a person was thinking at the time he made a decision to do something or not to do something. So in history, as new information comes to light and books are being written and rewritten, we call this revisionism. That is, we're revising history as we gain more knowledge, similar to on the physical science side. As we gain new knowledge, we insert this new knowledge into our models and we can make better predictions on what we should be seeing. In history, as we apply this new information, we understand what really was going on, perhaps, with this new understanding, perhaps know where the mistakes were made. Perhaps then, if we pay attention, we can avoid similar errors. And this works really good. I mean, it's a fairly decent system. Again, it can be manipulated a little bit, and that's what I'm going to get into here in a little bit. So this term revisionism, sometimes, I mean, in the purest sense, it is what history is. History does. It revises itself. But in a way, when you look at some of the stuff that's been coming up as late, especially with conspiracy theories, a kind of a revisionism has been taking place. My first introduction to revisionism and revisionists was actually out of Gordon Prange's book, At Dawn We Slept. One of the final chapters that was added in, apparently it was added after the book was pretty much put together. It was going to be its own volume in itself, but it was decided to attach it to the book. This chapter was called Revisionists Revisited. And in this was basically a commentary on some of the early conspiracies that were coming out of conspiracy theories that were being generated based on Pearl Harbor. If you remember from my first part of the Pearl Harbor conspiracies, I talked a little bit about guys like John Flynn and Charles Baird. And there's this, and in that discussion, hopefully I made it clear that much of these early conspiracies were based on a dislike of Franklin Roosevelt. Now, there is actually an entire industry built upon hating Franklin Roosevelt. There's a lot of people who believe that he was like one of the worst presidents we've had. And of course, they happily write on all the terrible things, all the socialism that he brought in and how he was a communist or he was this or he was that. And when I first became aware of this after reading At Dawn We Slept, created an interest in how history is put together. Now, I come to find out, and then as years went on, I first read read Prange's book, probably in the mid 80s, maybe early 90s. And since then, I noticed there's and thanks to the internet, this kind of a growing, industry of pseudo history. Now, the idea is that, and when you look at this concept of pseudo history, when we look at pseudoscience, we're looking at things like acupuncture, chiropractic, homeopathy, those type of things. And these were all kind of based on a kind of, kind of unprovable or unsubstantiated forces. I mean, apparently things like acupuncture and chiropractic, the earliest forms of chiropractic, is based on these energies. And Unfortunately, these energies have never been identified or proven to exist. It's just what people want you to believe. In the concept of pseudo-history, we have a pretty dedicated group of amateur historians who have did things like in Zachariah Sitchin's case, he totally misinterprets Sumerian writing and wants you to believe that there's this Planet X that comes into play every so many thousands of years or tens of thousands, whatever the number is, whatever number you prefer to use, basically making up a false history. And then there's even those who believe that parts of history have been erased for whatever reason. There was just a recent Skeptoid episode on Pope Joan. There was supposedly a female pope, but for whatever reason, she's been blanked out of the papal record. Now, these alternative histories have never been proven. There's no evidence that any of this kind of stuff ever happened. Most of the times, it's all make-believe anyhow. There's no basis in fact for anything Sitchin says, because he gets all the Sumerian writing wrong. He has no concept of what he's reading, and he's made up this language. Whereas professionals who have studied the Sumerian language has already proven that he is totally, basically, full of crap. So, there is this core who wants you to believe that certain things didn't happen or didn't happen the way the mainstream history wants you to believe. One of the major players in this pseudo-history is Holocaust denial. Many of these writers believe that, for whatever reason, I don't know where they come up with this, with their information. They seem to think things like the numbers 6 million Jews going into the gas chambers couldn't happen because physically, and based on whatever calculations they've come up with, claims that the ovens could not support this many people going through. But of course, that's not exactly a true number. 6 million didn't go through the ovens. We have evidence that most of them had been starved to death in death camps, or killed outright in places like the Ukraine. Actually, maybe only half of the Jews actually went into the gas chamber, the Auschwitzes and the Treblinkas and those type of places that had gas chambers and crematoria. So based on that, they want you to believe that the Holocaust never happened, or it didn't happen the way we say it happened. Though we do have the German records of people, what they knew, what the Germans knew, what they were doing. We even have guys like Adolf Eichmann and what he did, and his basic role in the Holocaust. We know that it wasn't until 1942 was the concept of using gas chambers and crematoria to deal with the Jews. So there's this core group that wants you to believe that, one, it didn't happen. And of course, then this is like the part of this Jewish conspiracy, this globalist agenda that I've been talking about, where they'll eventually take over and run the world. Sometimes it is just it has to do with end times. I believe it has, as long as they occupy Israel, that they will be the ones going, not the true Christians type of thing. And all sorts of crazy, crazy stuff like that. So the idea that there's this revision, it's referred to revisionist history. There's kind of this fine line between revisionism and denialism. And denialism is just basically ignore the facts type of stuff. And again, it's those who follow the Sitchins or who follow the Alex Joneses or the David Icke's. Actually, I'm kind of looking into this guy called Jordan Maxwell. He's been going on lately he's been going on this thing about we're not citizens or, you know, whatever. I have to look more into it, but basically denying the facts, denying things like, and this is typical, like with the global warming denialists. They want you to believe that none of this is, you know, it's not happening. It's not real. It's all make-believe. The data that the scientists are presenting is all wrong or doesn't exist, whatever their game is. Now, I wanted to talk about these three because this is kind of a heart and soul of conspiracies that we want to, as we try to understand events that present themselves, we want to better understand what was going on, why, you know, and from a, you know, in history, you know, what mistakes did our predecessors make? Yeah, that's not really good. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this. This seems to be some of the core aspects of many conspiracies. Try to change the history, try to manipulate the facts, or even just deny that the facts actually happen. These are common tactics amongst conspiracy theorists. But in a way, it's almost like, at least, again, some of the same problems that we're seeing in science, basically people not understanding the science behind evolution or global warming or, you know, basic physics, not understanding those, you know, what we do know, what we believe to be true. In history, we have a lot more gaps. We've got a lot more problems. We don't really understand some events because, for whatever reason, time, I mean, one of the common, at least in the revisionist camp, the Battle of Agincourt. This is one of my favorites, where the English, who had one of my favorite, a very good example of revisionism has been the work on understanding the Battle of Agincourt. This was an English victory against France in the Hundred Years' War, where Henry V, trying to exert his claims to northern France, invaded, took the town of Harfleur, and then having taken too long, they needed to find a way back to England. They were going to march on to Calais and met the bulk of the French army at the Battle of Agincourt. Now, some of the popular histories placed Henry's armies at, you know, a few thousand and 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 French, and yet managed to defeat the French. And of course, this was immortalized in Shakespeare's Henry V, you know, the famous, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, he who dies with me this day shall be my brother. And over time, since this was a battle that was fought in 1415, a lot more legend has been attributed to Agincourt than fact, and kind of a mystique. And it's also like the same as, William Wallace of Braveheart fame. He seems to be more legend than fact. But what's kind of interesting is just fairly recently, over the past maybe 10 years, a reassessment of the Battle of Agincourt may have been actually a 3-1 or a 4-1 in favor of French. Still a pretty serious defeat for France and an amazing victory for the English. But even then, understanding the battlefield what's being displayed as, you know, what's believed to be the battlefield, you actually have a situation where, kind of like, if you've seen the the movie 300, kind of the same situation at where Leonidas tried to force the Persians into the Hot Gates, if you remember that part. That's what actually happened at Agincourt. They believe that the French were being funneled into a small killing area, and so the weight of the French army could not be brought to bear against the British or the English, and of course the English longbowmen, ripping up the ranks that were hung up in the rear. I mean, just created a great bloody mess. And when all said and done, the English succeeds. And with this reassessment, and it's still pretty, to me, it's still pretty impressive that the English, he wanted to say British, but the English success, I am sure there's those in England who, I don't know if that's really, you know, how big of a deal that was, where that the revising of this, of the numbers and so on, it's probably not as big a deal, but it might be big to some people. I mean, there's probably some old timers who are convinced that it may have been a 5 or 10 to 1 in favor of the French, but with the new scholarship and the countings and the research that was being done, finding it may have been smaller, like in the 2 to 3, maybe 4 to 1 ratios. While it's important to to understand and appreciate what went on, But now that the idea is to better understand the purpose of this revision is to better understand the history, identify, basically trying to identify what went right, what went wrong. Hopefully we don't make these same mistakes. That's basically what we're trying to do with the history. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this. This seems to be some of the core aspects of many conspiracies. Try to change the history, try to manipulate the facts, or even just deny that the facts actually happen. These are common tactics amongst conspiracy theorists. But in a way, it's almost like, at least, again, some of the same problems that we're seeing in science, basically people not understanding the science behind evolution or global warming or basic physics, not understanding those, what we do know, what we believe to be true. In history, we have a lot more gaps. We've got a lot more problems. We don't really understand some events because, for whatever reason, time, I mean, what was the, what really did happen? Like, one of the common, a very good example of revisionism has been the work on understanding the Battle of Agincourt. This was an English victory against France in the Hundred Years' War, where Henry V, trying to exert his claims to northern France, invaded, took the town of Harfleur, and then he needed to find a way back to England. They were going to march on to Calais and met the bulk of the French army at the Battle of Agincourt. Now, some of the popular histories placed Henry's armies at a few thousand and 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 French, and yet managed to defeat the French. And of course, this was immortalized in Shakespeare's Henry V, the famous, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. He who dies with me this day shall be my brother." And over time, since this was a battle that was fought in 1415, a lot more legend has been attributed to Agincourt than fact, and kind of a mystique. And it's also like the same as
William Wallace of Braveheart fame. He seems to be more legend than fact. But yeah, what's kind of interesting is just fairly recently, over the past maybe 10 years, a reassessment of the Battle of Agincourt may have been actually a 3-1 or a 4-1 in favor of French. Still a pretty serious defeat for France, and a kind of an amazing victory for the English. But even then, understanding the battlefield and what's being displayed as, what's believed to be the battlefield, you actually have a situation where, kind of like if you've seen the movie 300, a kind of a same situation at where Leonidas tried to force the Persians into the Hot Gates. If you remember that part, that's what actually happened at Agincourt. They believe that the French were being funneled into a small killing area, and so the weight of the French army could not be brought to bear against the English. And of course, the English longbowmen ripping up the ranks that were hung up in the rear, I mean, just created a great bloody mess. And when all said and done, the English succeeds. And with this reassessment, and it's still pretty impressive that the English success, the revising of this, of the numbers and so on, it's probably not as big a deal, but it might be big to some people. I mean, there's probably some old timers who are convinced that it may have been a 5 or 10-1 in favor of the French, but with the new scholarship and the countings and the research that was being done, finding it may have been smaller, like in the 2 to 3, maybe 4-1 ratios. The purpose of this revision is to better understand the history, basically trying to identify what went right, what went wrong. Hopefully we don't make these same mistakes. That's basically what we're trying to do with the history. But in a lot of cases, especially with conspiracy theories, So for a conclusion, revisionism is the normal procedure for adding or changing our current understanding of an event. Revisionism, in the purest sense, is the normal procedure to revise the current knowledge to reflect factual information. Denialism is the rejection of facts to support alternatives. Denialism takes a real event and attempts to either remove or diminish portions of the event to modify the importance or reduce the importance of that event. Pseudohistory is just a revised history, inserting non-factual or unrelated facts and promoted as real history. This is a very common thing amongst conspiracy theories. We find numerous times where non-factual rumor, what have you, has been inserted as history. And hopefully in future podcasts, I'm hoping to demonstrate that a little bit more, but this is just a basic idea of what I'm trying to accomplish. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebowler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Tsarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.